In the matter of the estate of Crystal Walcott Spill versus Jacob Markovitz, M.D., may we please have appearances of counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, justices, Mike Riccadulli from on behalf of the petitioner, Dr. Paganese, and anesthesia and pain management.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Dennis Donnelly from the Donnelly Law Firm on behalf of the respondent, the estate of Crystal Walcott Spill.
Good afternoon, Honorable
Justice
Christina
Bassett,
on behalf of the amicus, New Jersey Association.
Welcome, counsel. Mr.
Riccadulli,
please go ahead.
May it please the court. I would like to reserve rebuttal time, kindly. This appeal is on behalf of Dr. Paganese and Anesthesia and Pain Management Group to decide the issue, as has been essentially been invited by the appellate division, to determine that an out-of-state tortfeasor can be on the verdict sheet in New Jersey where the plaintiff did not sue that tortfeasor in New Jersey. We submit that that answer should be yes, as that is consistent with the Joint Tortfeasors Contribution Act, as well as the Comparative Negligence Act. Such a holding is, as claimed by the opposition, that the plaintiffs would be prejudiced and or that there would be an appropriate remedy for contribution that Dr. Paganese would have to bring in New York against Dr. Deep in this case is meritless. In this case, specifically, the defendants are seeking to bring in or to have on the verdict sheet Dr. Deep, who is a rheumatologist, the patient's rheumatologist for 6 or 7 years, who was treating the patient for lupus. We have an expert in this case who states that Dr. Deep deviated from accepted standards of care. Plaintiffs have retained their own rheumatologist in this case, who concludes that Dr. Deep did not deviate. It's undisputed in this case that New Jersey has no jurisdiction over Dr. Deep. Dr. Deep's offices are in New York. Dr. Deep doesn't reside in New Jersey. So that point is undisputed. Consequently, should the case go to trial and Dr. Deep not be allowed to be on the verdict sheet, it would be unfair and prejudicial to the defendants in this case if they could not get allocation as to Dr. Deep. If I may, just give a brief factual background to the case.
You're welcome to do so, but we are familiar with the facts. Go ahead.
Okay, just very briefly, because it does provide some context for which they're opposing this case. As I mentioned, Dr. Deep was the patient's rheumatologist who was treating the patient for lupus. 8 days prior to the surgery in question on February 8th, Dr. Deep increased the medication that the patient was taking, lisinopril, for patient's renal dysfunction. And Dr. Deep did so without checking the labs in the case. The risk of increasing lisinopril is that in someone with kidney dysfunction, that can increase the patient's potassium. And in someone who has increased potassium, that increases the risk of a cardiac arrhythmia and cardiac arrest, which is exactly what occurred here during the very minor procedure that was performed by the defendants in this case. The patient underwent a LEAP procedure, which is about a 15-minute procedure done at a surgery center under mild sedation. And during that, the patient had a cardiac arrest. And it is the defense position that it was the failure of Dr. Deep to have checked the labs before increasing that lisinopril that was the cause of the arrest. And in fact, the plaintiff's claim against Dr. Paganese and Dr. Markovitz in this case is that they failed to check with Dr. Deep before the surgery and or obtain their own labs or obtain the labs that were done by Dr. Deep. In essence, they're claiming that our doctors should have done what Dr. Deep should have done in this case. And that's why I believe it's important to bring out those facts that Dr. Deep is a necessary state party. As it turns out, the patient wound up dying later that day and the labs came back after the patient had died. The plaintiffs in this case, for whatever reason, never chose or failed to sue Dr. Deep in this case. It was their prerogative to sue Dr. Deep if they wanted to in New York, and they chose not to or failed to do so. The Joint Tortfeasor Contribution Law and Comparative Negligence Act were designed to further the principle that it's only fair for each party, or I'm sorry, for each tortfeasor to pay for injuries he or she proximately caused. Numerous cases have come down that the determination as to whether a tortfeasor should be on a verdict sheet against whom an existing party can obtain allocation is not based upon the collectability or non-collectability by the plaintiff as to that tortfeasor.
You're relying on the CNA, correct?
Correct.
And that statute only provides for apportionment to parties to a suit, correct?
The language in the CNA says the word parties, but the Joint Tortfeasor Act, which is read in conjunction with the CNA, doesn't deal with parties. It deals with tortfeasors. Not only that, subsequent case law interpreting the CNA has held, and I was going to get to this, has held that allocation can be to non-parties. For example, in the Mason versus the New Jersey Transit case, that's a case where there was a bottle thrower. Okay, that person was not named as a party by the plaintiff, not even as a John Doe. And the appellate division determined in that case that that non-party should be on the verdict sheet for which the existing defendants, New Jersey Transit, should get allocation against. Similarly, in the Krasgowski case versus Tyndall, that was the phantom driver case, and that's the most recent in a line of phantom driver cases, where again, the phantom driver is not a party in the case, they were a John Doe. And the appellate division, and as approved by this court, determined that that non-party should be also on the verdict sheet.
It seems like if you can deduce any guiding principles from those decisions where allocation or no allocation is appropriate to a non-party, it seems to be that when a potential tortfeasor was a proper party or could have been a party, then allocation is allowed. Generally, it's but for some sort of mistake on the part of the plaintiff, but then there's other cases that have dealt with other statutes, for example, car insurance policies. But here you agree that Dr. Deep never could have been a party to this case because New Jersey could not exercise personal jurisdiction over Dr. Deep, correct?
I agree that Dr. Deep could not be a party in New Jersey, but Dr. Deep could be a party in New York.
Correct. And your client could sue Dr. Deep for contribution in New York.
And I was, again, getting to that second point. That is untenable in this case. New York has recently strengthened their statute of limitation laws. It's a hard line, 2.5 years from the day of malpractice. They have two exceptions. One is for a foreign object left in. That's 1 year after the discovery of the foreign object, or 2.5 years in a failure to diagnose cancer case. Other than that, it's 2.5 years from the date of the malpractice. New York has made it very clear.
I'm sorry, I wasn't asking about the statute about whether the plaintiff here could have sued Dr. Deep. I'm saying your client, if your client has not actually been ordered to pay anything, correct?
Correct. And I was getting to that point in that the time frame accrues against my clients would be is when there's a judgment or payment on behalf of our clients. That's when that would accrue for a contribution action.
So the statute of limitation can't possibly have run against that because there has been no judgment, correct?
That is correct. But the point is that this would be right now, okay, this action is in 2018, okay? That's when the cause of action accrued. If this case was brought in New York, simultaneous with this case, if plaintiff chose to sue Dr. Deep in New York, then it would be in August of 2020 that they should have brought it. We are now in 2024. Let's say the case is tried in 2 years, and then we still have 2.5 years to bring an action, a contribution action against Dr. Deep. We're talking anywhere from 8 to 10.5 years.
Can you, but just to the basic question of whether you can pursue that contribution action.
I say it's highly.
It was not a lot in the briefs about.
Highly in doubt. And the reason
highly,
for it, highly in doubt that New York would allow that because it would run afoul of their hardline 2.5-year statute of limitation. And they would consider a New Jersey defendant bringing a claim for contribution against one of their doctors, one of their New York doctors, a medical malpractice action. The case law that we did cite in our brief.
Let me stop you 1 second.
Sure.
The statute of limitations, as you mentioned, a contribution claim accrues under New Jersey law at the time of the judgment against you. Am I right about that? That's been the law for really decades.
Correct.
Right. So what is the New York rule about the accrual of a contribution claim? Because they have a contribution statute.
They have a contribution statute, and that statute does not address specifically foreign defendants coming into their jurisdiction.
But in general, what is the statute of limitations? If let's say New York doctors were fighting among themselves, but there was no cross claim filed in the underlying suit, later bringing a contribution action, what is the statute? If you know.
I don't know specifically because I don't think the statute CPLR 1403 or 1401 specifically says that.
But you just agreed that the statute of limitations, would not begin to run until there was a judgment to request contribution from.
Right.
And that seems clear from the fact that it says in CPLR 1403 that a contribution claim, quote, may be asserted in a separate action. So you can't assert a contribution claim unless you have a judgment for which you're asking for contribution in a separate action, correct?
Correct. However, that statute deals with the underlying action being in New York, number one. In two cases, Cooney versus Osgood Machinery and Vermont Construction, Inc., clearly state that contribution actions should be discouraged whenever possible, number one. And in Vermont, they tried to bring in a Vermont defendant tried to bring in a contribution action in New York. And the court made a determination that the location for a contribution action should be where the wrong occurred. And in this case, the wrong occurred in New Jersey. That's where the death occurred. That's where the surgery occurred. That's where the patient lived. That's where there was minimal contact.
There's no personal jurisdiction over Dr. Deep in New Jersey.
What's that?
Here, there's no personal jurisdiction over Dr. Deep in New Jersey.
Correct.
So there cannot be a suit against Dr. Deep in New Jersey.
Correct.
Sounds like from what you've just said that you have a reasonable argument that you can seek contribution within 2.5 years after a judgment.
And what I'm saying is that I think based upon the law, I don't know that New York would actually grant that to us in from New Jersey to New York.
Has there ever been a case in New York that has held that some New York person against whom personal jurisdiction could not be exercised in a different state, that person could not be put to a contribution claim in New York?
That was the Vermont Construction Inc. case that I cited in my brief, number one. Number two, the equities mitigate against that.
Do we know something about that, the Vermont case which you cited? Do we know whether there was a jurisdictional issue had the case been brought against all defendants in the state where the harm occurred? In other words, do you know whether there was a jurisdictional problem with getting that defendant into that state?
I don't, and I don't know that the case was specific enough to address that.
Yeah.
Case. Yeah. I don't think it addresses that in the opinion itself. But here's the point, Judge. The equities of the situation really, in this case, we would be bringing a case for contribution 8 or 10.5 years, depending on when that case is brought, after judgment against the defendants in New Jersey, after the events occurred. And that would entail having to do a whole new separate lawsuit with discovery. So there wouldn't even be a verdict for another 2 or 3 years after that. We're talking that this contribution action would get adjudicated in New York some 12 or 13 years after the events occurred in 2018. Considerable time and an expense would have to be made, and then there would have to be a trial in New York based upon an incomplete determination of comparative negligence in New York, because they wouldn't be comparing the negligence of the defendants in New Jersey, after an incomplete determination of negligence in New Jersey, because Dr. Deep would not be on the verdict sheet.
Suppose we allowed an allocation of fault as against Dr. Deep, would there be a complete ability for a jury to make the determination of who's responsible? How would it play out in practice if there's no attorney for Dr. Deep, if there are no experts being called on behalf of Dr. Deep to explain the situation? What guidance would a jury have?
That is tantamount to all the other situations where a dismissed defendant is allowed on the verdict sheet. A settling defendant doesn't have an attorney there or an expert there on their behalf. A dismissed defendant pursuant to the affidavit of merit of statute of limitations, they're on the verdict sheet, but they don't have an attorney or an expert on their behalf. In this case, we have an expert against Dr. Deep. Plaintiff has an expert in favor of Dr. Deep.
You couldn't have testimony from Dr. Deep against a settling defendant. You don't need, I mean, the defendant chose to settle. So I assume there's some sort of stipulation that the parties reach that explains that settlement. And then that goes into how the jury instructions are crafted. But there can't be any such stipulation here about Dr. Deep because Dr. Deep is not in the case and did not settle.
Well, if Dr. Deep was allowed to be on the verdict sheet, it would be to answer Justice Radner's question, it would be no different than if Dr. Deep was a New Jersey defendant and was dismissed from the case pursuant to the affidavit of merit statute or pursuant to statute limitations, or if Dr. Deep was bankrupt. All those have been adjudicated and upheld by this court. So the fact that Dr. Deep has no defense, Dr. Deep is not paying any verdict either. So it would be up to the plaintiff to then, you know, just as in those situations, to then say, no, the allocation of negligence should be the named defendants in this case and not Dr. Deep, which is exactly what the plaintiffs did in this case.
Irrespective of the verdict sheet, the experts, it's anticipated, would testify about Dr. Deep's participation in the treatment, correct?
Correct.
So why isn't the proximate cause charge enough for the jury to make a determination regarding liability without looking at the verdict sheet specifically?
Yes, and that was something that was raised by the appellate division. And in our response in our brief is they're not mutually exclusive. The defendants should be able to argue proximate causation, for example, substantial factor, and also argue that there is negligence by another tortfeasor. It is conceivable that a jury can find substantial factor on one of the defendants, but also find and apportion negligence to Dr. Deep in the case, thereby reduce.
In order to be helped by the proximate cause standard, your client would have to prove that it had zero responsibility to break the chain of causation. Am I right about that? In other words, without an allocation, in order to have your client not be liable at all, your client would have to prove that they had zero responsibility because it was all on Dr. Deep. You see what I'm saying?
Well,
am I right about that?
I don't think that we would have to prove 0%. We'd have to prove that our negligence was not a substantial factor.
Right.
So that doesn't translate to 0%, but it's arguable what percentage constitutes.
It could translate to 5%.
Yeah, or something along those lines.
In other words, that you would have to, the proofs would have to show, forget burdens of proof, proofs would have to show that your client had an absolutely minimal role in this, as opposed to an allocation in which your client could be allocated a significant role in it, but it could be offset by any allocation to Dr.
Exactly.
Deep. So the two are really very, very different in their application.
Correct. And so therefore the ability to argue causation, in other words, what you're suggesting is, well, we're going to argue that the injuries were proximately caused by Dr. Deep. We still should be able to argue that Dr. Deep should be on the verdict sheet and there's an allocation of negligence as to Dr. Deep. We should be able to argue both, and the jury can find whatever it finds on both questions.
Back to the chief's question, doesn't that allocation on the verdict sheet independently potentially confuse the jury when there was no defense, there was no attorney, there is no Dr. Deep in court, but suddenly they're attributing and adding a percentage at that last critical juncture?
Again, no. Again, whether there's a settling defendant and nobody's there defending that defendant, or so not to confuse the issue of that defendant paid, whether that they're dismissed pursuant to the statute of limitations, affidavit of merit, bankruptcy, any Tort Claims Act, all those things that have been sanctioned by this court as an appropriate reason to get an allocation against such a defendant, that same situation would exist here.
Actually, that's not the case. In all of those examples that you just gave, the settling defendant, the dismissed defendant on statute of limitations grounds, the dismissed defendant on affidavit of merit grounds, the dismissed defendant on Tort Claims Act grounds, and the dismissed defendant on bankruptcy grounds. The common denominator there is that all of those defendants were parties to the litigation, unlike here. So I don't understand the basis for your contention that the joint tort fusion contribution law permits you to name Dr. Deep on the verdict sheet solely because it might be difficult to collect on a contribution claim in New York. Well, I don't understand the connection between both.
Okay. In Mason, as well as the Krasowski case, they were not parties.
Well, tell me about the bottle thrower in Mason. Why was that individual on the verdict sheet?
The individual was on the verdict sheet because the courts determined that it would be unfair and prejudicial to the defendants not to be able to apportion liability as to that bottle thrower, irrespective of the fact that they are not a named defendant in the case.
I'm looking at the case, and I thought that it's reasoned that the plain language of the Tort Claims Act, which is not relevant here, quote, requires an apportionment of fault between tortfeasors without exception and regardless of whether a tortfeasor is named as a party in the action. That makes it seem like the case was decided under a totally different statute, which does not include the word party, unlike the CNA, which does include the word party.
Well, I don't know that in its rationale that it hung its hat on the Tort Claims Act for that proposition, and I don't think it did. While, yes, the Tort Claims Act was applicable to New Jersey Transit, it certainly was not applicable to the bottle thrower. So,
but in Mason, the Tort Claims Act argument was, in fact, to the benefit of transit because the statute says that you have presumably to preserve public funds, that if there is somebody else potentially at fault here, that they are on the verdict sheet.
It was a consideration from the court, but that wasn't the rationale that it used. And matter of fact,
that you specifically said the TCA requires an apportionment of fault between tortfeasors without exception and regardless of whether a tortfeasor is named as a party in the action. That's just not applicable to the CNA because the CNA does not say that all possible joint tortfeasors must have an apportionment of fault, even if they're not a party. Instead, it refers only to apportionment between parties.
Well, that wasn't what was held in Krasowski. So I don't want if the Tort Claims Act is something that is going to like cloud the issue, then we can go to Krasowski, which held the same thing for
But Krasowski dealt with a nuance of the, I think it's the no fault law. There was a statutory aspect to that.
There was a UM aspect to that, but then again, that wasn't the basis for their holding. In that case was, again, that it would be prejudicial to the defendants to not be able to allocate liability to that unidentified phantom driver. And there's a whole line of cases that Krasowski cited, even in Krant. I'm sorry.
But even that case, the phantom driver case, is very different than the facts of this case. In that case, they read the Tort Claims Act, not Tort Claims, the Comparative Negligence Act and the Joint Tort Fees Contribution Law Act in connection with the uninsured motorist statute. And the idea was to make sure that the plaintiff wasn't unjustly enriched from receiving money from both the tort feeser and the phantom vehicle whose negligence would be paid out by the UM carrier. That's not this case.
Yeah, but that wasn't the only consideration by the court in Krasowski. That the court, again, made it very clear that collectability or non-collectability by the plaintiff is not a factor in determining whether that phantom driver should be on the verdict sheet or not.
Did the plaintiff in that case receive UM proceeds?
In that, the decision doesn't address that specific issue. But in that case, the plaintiff, like in this case, made all the same arguments. Amicus made the same arguments in that case as they'd made in this case, and they were soundly rejected.
That does address UM. It specifically says, quote, by requiring that automobile insurance policies include a UM provision, the legislature has acknowledged and prepared for precisely such circumstances. So again, it seems to be relying on another law that says, in the case of an unidentified motorist, then apportionment must be required, or in a TCA case where it doesn't say the word party, apportionment must be required.
Again, understanding that it acknowledged that there is UM law, that wasn't the rationale behind the case for deciding what it decided. It didn't say how much they can get from UM. It didn't get into that particular aspect of it. The party there was named as a John Doe. The decision dealt with that action and not a UM action, and whether they can, how much they can get, whether it would be made whole or anything along those lines. The issue in both of those cases, in both Krasowski and Mason, was fundamental fairness to the existing defendants in the case. And that's the whole point behind the Joint Tortfeasor Act, was to ameliorate the harshness of existing defendants not being able to recover from other defendants in the case simply because plaintiff chose not to sue them.
Plaintiff didn't have a choice here. They couldn't sue Dr. Deep in New Jersey.
Right. Right. But in this case, they did have a choice. They could have sued Dr. Deep in New York. They could have sued Dr. Deep in New York, just like in Kranz versus Schuss, where the plaintiff chose to sue the defendants in New York, and they achieved a settlement. And for that purpose, the defendants were then allowed to get an allocation against those defendants in this case. But here, and in Kranz, Judge Misano made it very clear that they are not considered to be parties in New Jersey. They can't be because there's no jurisdiction here.
But Kranz is really an outgrowth of Young versus Lotta, isn't it? It's a settlement. I mean, obviously, pure definition of parties in the sense of currently a party in the case went out 30, maybe even 40 years ago with Young. I forget the exact date, 1978 or something like that. Because settling parties are no longer current parties. But Kranz is a logical extension of that because of the parallel action in New York that the plaintiffs brought, they were settling parties. And it's a relatively easy jump from Young to what the appellate division did in Kranz. But this is different. I mean, I think what's potentially relevant about Kranz is the fact that there were parallel actions, but the status of that defendant who settled in New York is the status of a settling defendant, which for decades has required an allocation if the non-settling defendant goes through all of the requirements to get them on the verdict sheet.
And I would agree.
Sufficient.
No, I would agree with that. But the problem is that unlike in Young versus Latta, where those settling defendants in New Jersey, the existing or the remaining defendants could not get an allocation against those out-of-state settling defendants until the Kranz case came down. And the logic, though, behind it.
But Young didn't deal with that either way. Young didn't deal with out-of-state either way.
Right.
Kranz was the first case, and as far as I know, the only case that dealt with the out-of-state settling defendant.
Correct.
But it still is a settling defendant. And that does distinguish it from your case.
It does distinguish it from this case, but I would submit that the logic that was used to decide that case is the same as we're asking this court to decide this case, in that the idea under, again, the Joint Tortfeasors Contribution Act and the Comparative Negligence Act is fundamental fairness and prejudice to the existing defendants in the case. And my submission is that a subsequent contribution action some 8 to 10 to 11 years later in a different jurisdiction is in question seriously by the language in New York, by the case law in New York, and in the remoteness in time it's not equitable. That's what they're suggesting that our remedy should be. Plaintiff had the ability to sue Dr. Deep in New York. They chose not to.
Isn't part of the reason for the length of litigation in this case you raise it, you litigating this question, which of course you have the right to do, but it then seems unfair to say, you know, well, this case has proceeded for so long, so now by the time we're held liable, it will be so many years after the fact, when that's because you're raising issues that you have every right to raise.
Whether it's 8 years or 10 years or 12 years, because we're raising this issue, if we just back it up a year or two still, if it's 6 years, 8 years, 10 years, it's still a long period of time that, you know, witnesses are now going to be, you know, their memories are going to fail. People may be retiring.
Has Dr. Deep been deposed?
Yes.
Is her testimony recorded on video?
I don't think it was recorded on video.
Just on transcript.
Yes.
Just on a transcript.
Yes.
I'm reading directly from the JTCL. It seems to contemplate that this could happen years after the fact. It says, where injury or damage is suffered by any person as a result of a wrongful act, and the person so suffering injury or damage recovers a money judgment or judgments for such injury against one or more joint tortfeasors, either in one action or in separate actions, and any one of the joint tortfeasors pays such judgment in whole or in part, he shall be entitled to recover contribution from the other joint tortfeasor for the excess so paid over his pro rata share. That just seems to acknowledge exactly what you're saying should never happen, that one person pays and then they can recover whatever they paid in excess of their pro rata share. The statute doesn't say anything about that not being permissible. That's exactly what it's saying is permissible.
I understand that, but it is silent as to any specific about an out-of-state defendant in the case. It doesn't talk about the equities of that situation. It doesn't talk about the logistics of the situation. It doesn't talk about whether it's even possible from based upon the laws of that other jurisdiction. So in this case, it is the basically the plaintiff is putting the defense in that position to have to go after the out-of-state defendant, and we don't know whether we can do that or not. If we do it will be many, many years later, however many.
Would Dr. Deep have an entire controversy defense to any contribution action?
Conceitedly, I don't know if there's an entire controversy doctrine equivalent in New York.
Okay. But she could never have been brought into any case in New Jersey because there's no personal jurisdiction against her. Correct. So how could there possibly be an entire controversy?
I wouldn't think that that would be something, if there was such an entire controversy doctrine in New York, that would be a viable defense, assuming that the court would allow a contribution action there. But the statute, though, doesn't discuss specifically out-of-state tortfeasors. And again, what is analogous to Kranz in the case is that there the plaintiff chose to sue those out-of-state defendants, and here they simply chose not to. So that choice should not then be harbored upon the defendants now to pick that up some 7, 8, 10 years later, then to go out of state and then have to file a contribution claim.
Counsel, you placed great emphasis on the delay that you anticipate in this case, and I understand the reasons why. If we could roll the clock back and cut that in half, you'd still be making the same legal argument, wouldn't you?
I would still be making the same legal argument, but I'm talking about the equity of the situation, the realities of the situation. If New York has a strict 2.5-year statute of limitations, understanding that the statute of limitations runs from a claim of contribution, New York is going to say, you are 8 years outside of suing our doctors.
I understand your argument. I don't want to go over it again. I'm just wondering about its strength, and that's why I asked the question.
Yeah.
But your cause of action accrues when you have a judgment. And yes. In looking at the reality of this case, this is not an accident where there were witnesses on the road who may have disappeared or forgot about it. This is a case that comes down to whether or not the doctor deviated from standard of care. And if so, to what extent would you have, if you were hit with a judgment, would your clients have overpaid? And obviously your client's testimony would be part of that, as would basically other potential witnesses in a New Jersey case. But the doctor presumably is not going anywhere, and if it's less of a concern, I would respectfully suggest, than in a case where people walking down the street happen to see something and we don't know where they are, and they may not be able to show up live, and there may not be a proper preservation of their testimony. you're really dealing with a medical situation that's the medical records, the testimony of the doctor, perhaps conflicting testimony as to causation and the experts, right?
Yes, that's the nature of a medical malpractice case.
Right. So it is less, what I'm suggesting is perhaps you have less of a concern about memories fading than you would in another setting or if witnesses not being available.
Perhaps. I mean, you know, doctors retire, doctors leave the state. I mean, people die over that, course of time. The easier remedy and the more equitable remedy is to have all the parties in one lawsuit and the jury in New Jersey assessing it against all potential tortfeasors.
Interesting. You use the word parties.
Yeah.
How could they possibly decide the percentage to which Dr. Deep is liable if Dr. Deep is not there testifying?
Again, it would be the same as if Dr. Deep was dismissed from the case for.
But if Dr. Deep had settled, or if Dr. Deep had been dismissed from the case because of some wrongdoing by the plaintiff, like the affidavit of merit decision that basically said, you know, it's the plaintiff's fault that this person isn't in the case anymore and they were a party and then the plaintiff didn't do what they had to do. Very different situation here. You're relying on the fundamental equities, but I just don't understand why it's fundamentally fair to say to a jury, you're now deciding how much everyone was responsible, but you're not going to hear testimony from one of the main people that defendants say is responsible and that person didn't settle and plaintiff did not do anything wrong as to that person. This court simply does not have jurisdiction over that person and it has nothing to do with plaintiff and plaintiff is not at fault for the fact that there's no personal jurisdiction against Dr. Deep.
Well, again, the reality of it, if the doctor is dismissed, okay, the jury's not going to know that the doctor is not in the case because the plaintiff did something wrong. The jury's never going to know. Plaintiff failed to abide by the statute of limitations. That's why this doctor is not in this case. All they're going to know is that this doctor is on the verdict sheet and that they are to assess the liability as to this doctor. So they're not going to know the reasons behind it, and there's multiple reasons why the doctor would be, you know, on the verdict sheet because the plaintiff didn't do something that they were supposed to do, or if there is a bankruptcy. So it is exactly the same situation as that. And if plaintiff wanted to call Dr. Deep as a witness, they could. We could call Dr. Deep as a witness in this case. We have an expert in this case against Dr. Deep. They have an expert that says Dr. Deep did nothing wrong in the case.
That's why they didn't sue Dr. Deep. Their theory of the case is that the anesthesia defendants failed to get lab results. And had they done that, they would have known that her medication was doubled for her heart problem and that she had elevated potassium level. Given those two facts, it would have been appropriate to see either a nephrologist or somebody else before this individual was placed under anesthesia. That's their whole case. They can't sue for two reasons. A, New Jersey doesn't have jurisdiction, and B, there's no claim to be made that Dr. Deep deviated from the accepted standards within the rheumatologist profession. So that is totally different than what was happening in answer to the questions before about a plaintiff who does something to create the problem, like, oh, I didn't serve an affidavit of merit on time against this defendant, a party. That defendant is now dismissed. That shouldn't be the defendant's fault. That's the plaintiff's fault. Or I didn't serve a notice of tort claim under the Tort Claims Act. That's the plaintiff's fault, not the defense's fault. The defense should still be able to seek contribution. You put the liability of both up on the board and you make an allocation of fault. This is a completely different case. And it seems to me that you're relying solely on Mason and the Phantom Driver case as the legal opinions on which to base your contention that you should have Dr. Deep on the verdict sheet.
And I hear what you're saying. I do. I hear what you're saying. I'm focusing the court on those cases more than the other cases where a dismissed defendant is on the verdict sheet, simply because in those cases, the plaintiff had no choice, right? The plaintiff had no choice. It was a phantom driver. It was a John Doe. Nobody knows who it is. In this case, the plaintiff does have a choice. They have a choice to have sued Dr. Deep in New York. If Dr. Deep was sued in New York, then this case would fall under the Kranz versus Schuss case.
As Justice Bertrand pointed out, the reason that plaintiff did not sue Dr. Deep in New York is not because there's some nefarious scheme going on. It's because they don't think Dr. Deep did anything wrong. So it's very rare that you sue someone who you don't think did anything wrong. just because someone else thinks that that person did something wrong. Their position is Dr. Deep didn't do anything wrong. If your client wants to prove that Dr. Deep did something wrong, then your client can bring a contribution suit in New York. But it doesn't make any sense that they should have to be suing a party that they argue did absolutely nothing wrong.
Why can't they then defend it then? If Dr. Deep is on the verdict sheet, why can't they defend it like they would in a different situation that comes up where there's a, that party is not there and they're on their verdict sheet?
Isn't this your strongest case really Brodsky, Justice Albin's opinion in Brodsky, much more than the unidentified defendants, where the court talked about that it was bankruptcy, it had nothing to do with the plaintiff. And the plaintiff had not made a mistake or had a strategy that this party was unavailable to everybody because of a bankruptcy bar. So
I think the Brodsky
says that the allocation assures that defendants are not deprived of the benefits of the CNA, namely their right to be accountable only for their percentage of fault, provided that portion is less than 60%. Isn't that a much more analogous case for you than the unidentified tortfeasors in the Krasowski and Mazin?
I think it's a compelling case. The only reason I highlighted the Mason in the Krasowski case is because the plaintiff was forced basically by the courts to accept these defendants on the verdict sheet. Okay. They didn't do anything wrong in those cases either. That's the only reason I was focusing. I agree with you that Brodsky is also compelling because that's through no fault of the plaintiff either.
But in Brodsky, the dismissed defendant was a defendant. And just because the individual was dismissed because of being discharged in bankruptcy didn't prevent the defendant from seeking contribution under the joint tort business contribution law. But the percentage of fault went on the verdict sheet because the bankrupt individual had been a party to the litigation. Unlike Dr. Deep, who could never have been a party to this case.
Understood. And that's one of the reasons why I was focusing on the Mason and the Krasowski case, because they are not parties. They're tortfeasors.
So I think we understand your position. Okay. And we're beyond the half hour at this point. Anything you want to add at this point before rebuttal?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Thank you. Let me apologize to all counsel for the noise that we're hearing today. It did not show in your argument. We will pay attention to it after.
May it please the court. I'm not adverse to winning and rejecting this unmeritorious claim by A, the court's recognition already that New York does allow these defendants a contribution. I'm also not adverse to having this unmeritorious defense or seeking to put someone into the verdict sheet who doesn't belong on it based on the statute itself, which clearly denies that. But I think at least one of you, two of you actually, arrived at something deeper in the case and something critical for understanding why this is an inequitable, not equitable, approach to the case. Where New Jersey courts have stepped in, they've stepped in because they don't like a 200% recovery, a double recovery. They've never stepped in because they want a 50% recovery instead of 100% recovery, which is what is sought here. Whatever percentage in this sort of fictitious argument about Dr. Deep will be subtracted from the actual verdict and not recovered. But what's most critical is this, and two of you, I believe, already addressed this somewhat. The underlying facts in this case, okay, are that the autopsy report tells us definitively what caused this patient's death. She had sudden cardiac death, and this is PCA6, cause of death. Sudden cardiac death while under anesthesia for gynecologic procedure in a patient with systemic lupus nephritis class 4. The only two people managing the care when she died were Dr. Paganese, the anesthesiologist, and Dr. Markovitz, the New Jersey obstetrician. Both of them, according to our experts, and they have 10 experts trying to say they didn't, were grossly negligent, not just a little bit negligent, because they knew the patient had long-term lupus. They knew the patient had not one, but two specialists in New York, Dr. Deep, a nephrologist, a kidney doctor, and Dr. Kinsicki, a nephrologist, a kidney doctor, and Dr. Deep, a rheumatologist. They knew there were two experts in New York. And by the way, they could have made Dr. Deep a defendant in this case, with subject to jurisdiction, but of course it wouldn't have happened. They could have called her up and said, you know, we want to do surgery on this patient and we're going to use anesthesia and she's your patient, she has lupus, is that okay? It's called a surgical clearance. It's a very common practice. They might say, you know what, we don't really know a lot about lupus. They would be wrong. That's malpractice. But even if they had that position, but if they had called her up and she said, oh, go ahead and do it, that would have been single contact jurisdiction and it would have been malpractice. But she didn't do that. These two doctors deliberately excluded two New York doctors from knowing what they were going to do, which is to use anesthesia on a patient which was going to cause her to die. Because everybody is supposed to know that lupus patients, not just because their lisinopril was changed from 10 milligrams to 20 milligrams, but in general, have fluctuating values of potassium in their bloodstream. So it's gross malpractice to subject a patient like that to anesthesia, but they did it. And they had several ways of avoiding that. They could have got a clearance in New Jersey. They didn't do that. They could have spoken to Dr. Deep or Dr. Kinsicki. And if they did, they would have been told, don't be crazy. That's Russian roulette. Why can't you do the blood work first? And it's critical, by the way, that this is an elective procedure. If this patient was dying and they had to operate on the patient, well, then there would be an excuse for not finding this out. But so one document tells you what the whole case is about and has nothing to do with Dr. Deep. The patient died under anesthesia. Dr. Deep didn't treat the patient knowing that she was going to have anesthesia. Dr. Kinsicki in New York didn't treat the patient knowing they were going to have anesthesia, so they weren't operating under the same circumstances. There's no basis for comparison of fault because they had no fault. Yes.
Mr. Donnelly, obviously, you're going to argue your facts at some point to a jury, but we have a legal issue here and not, and in terms of what's a basis for comparison, our issue is, do the circumstances here warrant inclusion of this defendant on the verdict sheet? Let me address that.
I think it was Justice Frankfurter who once said something about sometimes, you know, you need concrete facts.
And we're aware of the facts. Aware of the facts, but we're not here to adjudge the allocation of fault.
Let me go directly to that.
Because, you know, obviously, if you look through all of the cases where the courts decided either to include an allocation or not include an allocation, you don't find this court getting into the allocation itself, because that's a determination, if it happens at all, for a fact finder.
I understand that. But the reason why I bring that up is this. Dr. Deep was never a joint tortfeasor because the tort only occurred when the surgical happened under anesthesia. All right.
That's not a determination for the court to make as to on a record, which is a discovery record, the ultimate determination of fault goes, the whole purpose of this exercise is it's the fact finder who makes that determination.
Let me turn directly to that issue you raised, which is a legal issue.
Right.
40 years ago, and I checked, I'm the oldest person in this courtroom, and you know, I was practicing 40 years ago when it came out. Ramos versus Browning Ferris in the Supreme Court completely decided the issue in front of you and decided the right way. And here's the way they did it. In that case, there was an issue about someone was injured and there was snow on the ground. And the Supreme Court affirmed the appellate division as filed. First of all, the appellate division said, there's no reason to have the fact finder assign a percentage of negligence to someone who was not affected by the verdict than to assign a percentage of negligence to acts of God, such as snow in this case. All right, now, The reason why I was going in the, so what does that say? It says that people have to accept the underlying facts the way they are, and then you have to judge whether they were negligent or in this case, whether it was malpractice. But frankly, if this defendant were a driver who was driving in the rain and caused a fatal accident, and he wanted you to allocate a percentage of fault to the rain, he would say, seriously, we can't do that. But the medical rain here, and it is the same, is that doctors take patients the way they find them. The doctors in New Jersey, when they did this procedure, had a patient who was susceptible to dying under anesthesia.
And again, respectfully, Mr. Drazen, I think you have a stronger argument if you address the legal issue.
Okay.
Because the argument that you are presenting to us would require us to make a determination on causation on when we are not jurors. Do you understand my point?
I do understand.
I think the more apt argument is to look at the rationale of the various cases where the court either has or has not allowed an allocation. Now, you mentioned Ramos. Ramos was a situation where the rationale of the court is this is the employer. The employer has the comp bar.
Right.
The employer is never going to be part of this case, could not be part of this case, and therefore there can't be an allocation of that employer.
But Ramos also said, quite specifically, the Supreme Court said, our legislature drafted a comparative negligence act to only consider the percentage of fault of parties to the case. Other states like Wisconsin have pure comparative negligence acts. And in Mason, it was a pure comparative negligence act. So what they're asking you to do here is not supported by the statute, is not supported either by the cause of death. And my point here is that the doctors, in this case in New Jersey, took this patient the way she presented, including whatever Dr. Deep or anyone else had done in New York. It was still their responsibility. And they were the only ones who had management of the death-causing event. So to reach out in a case like this and say it's equitable to somehow drag in Dr. Deep is extremely inequitable. And
if, for example, Dr. Deep was a situation like Burt with the AOM not being achieved or a settling defendant, et cetera, the court would allow an allocation if there was a sufficient showing and if there was notice and so forth.
Because she would be a party.
But you do not find in any of these decisions courts stepping on the role of the fact finder by making a determination saying, well, we don't think there's really a major responsibility here by this defendant or that defendant. It's a legal question which explores why are we here in this situation where this defendant's not a court.
I apologize. It's hard having a case for many years and being deeply involved in the case.
I understand.
And the facts of the case. But the point here is that no New Jersey case, but for a situation where there was a settlement, has a situation where there was a comparative negligence act that allowed non-parties to be on the verdict sheet, has ever done what they're asking you to do here. And my point is that there's no equitable reason that they give you to do that. One more thing, by the way, Judge. And again, I apologize somewhat. There were two New York doctors, the nephrologist and Dr. Deep. The nephrologist, Dr. Kansicki, happened to live in New Jersey, so we had jurisdiction over her. She was a party to the case. We explored her connection to the case, and both parties, plaintiff and all the defendants, let her out of the case because she didn't know what the doctors in New Jersey were going to do. So if you could call it judicial estoppel for a defendant who had experts, who had lawyers, they didn't want that defendant in the case any more than we did. They let her out.
I don't know that judicial estoppel is the way helps us.
What I'm saying is that it's inconsistent.
Let me just say, is the way you characterize it, is it your position that that it's either settling defendant or a pure comparative status. There's a lot of other cases that do not fit into either of those categories.
But,
and I'd ask you to address those.
But all those other cases fit into a different category, which is that the person now no longer in the case was a proper defendant in the case, but for an error in the affidavit of merit or some other error, everything fit within the statute because they were parties. Here we want to reach out and take someone who was never a party and never could be a party, and we want to add them to the mix. And the only reason we want to add them to the mix is to somehow drive down the percentage of responsibility by this defendant and make it unrecoverable for the plaintiff, whereas the defendant could recover it in contribution.
Okay. You also pointed out that there are many other states where there is a comparative negligence statute that requires apportionment between all persons, regardless of whether that person was ever a party to the case. For example, Arizona, in assessing percentages of fault, the trier of fact shall consider the fault of all persons who contributed to the alleged injury, regardless of whether the person was or could have been named as a party to the suit.
Yes.
I think your point there was, this is a question for the legislature. If the legislature wanted to amend our CNA to provide that apportionment must be between all persons and not all parties, then they would be free to make that judgment. But in the absence of that, we have no right to amend the statute and say, you know, we prefer the one in Arizona, which talks about persons instead of parties.
And indeed, the Arizona statute, by the way, also says that if the defendants get to bring in someone, then the statute of limitations is told, and maybe the plaintiffs can bring them in as well. But the point is well taken. Our legislature never gave the right that these defendants want. I've been trying to make the point is there's no equitable reason for them to get the right.
We hear that you're chomping to run to the equities, and that's come across loud and clear. I think Justice Patterson's questions may help focus.
Okay.
Your position.
I need all the help focusing I can get.
Your position as you began was there's no legal right under the statute. Dr. Deep was not, is not, and could not be a party.
Indeed.
Is that enough to resolve the case?
That's enough to resolve the case. And the amicus will also address why that statute applies and also why contribution would be allowed in New York. And so there's no equitable reason to allow what's being asked for here. Good.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Thank you. I think that's
it. Ms. Harvey.
The New Jersey Association for Justice is concerned about limiting a plaintiff's ability to fully recover by adding a non-party to the verdict sheet. Adding a non-party would be comparable to adding snow that the court in Ramos discussed at 103 NJ 177. Defendant talks about fundamental fairness, but here he just doesn't like the remedy that the defendant has. And defendant does have a remedy under the contribution law. This court has to take the plain language of both statutes, the Comparative Negligence Act and the Joint Tortfeasors Contribution Law.
Ms. Harvey, help us with that if you don't mind.
Yes.
I couldn't find anything in New York, and I am no expert on New York law, to indicate whether a situation like this would give rise to a contribution claim. I think, you know, years ago, there were these separate contribution claims in New Jersey, and obviously entire controversy affected that, et cetera. And now cross claims for contribution are brought in the same underlying case.
Correct.
Do you know what they would do with that? And if so, what's the basis for your knowledge?
Based upon the three cases that defendant cited, and if the court would permit supplemental briefing, there was another case, but because I haven't raised it to the other parties, I don't think it's fair to bring it up without supplemental briefing. But I think the three cases that defendant himself cited actually resolve the issue, because those three cases really talk about if there's a conflict of law. So the New York cases address a concern that are we going to permit contribution in New York on a case that maybe the tort was in a different jurisdiction? Some of the cases are in New York jurisdiction, but out of state parties. And will we let contribution? And they start from the premise of, is there a conflict at all? And here.
And just identify for us, because you said the defendants brought up these cases. There are a lot of cases cited in this case.
I think the best case to look at first would be the Cooney versus Osgood Machinery, Inc., 81 New York 2nd, 66. It's a 1993 case. That case actually overrules, not by name, that Vermont case, because Vermont case is just the Third Circuit, Third Department in New York. So that's just like the appellate division in New York. And the Cooney case is the Court of Appeals, which is their highest court. And in that case, they talk about lex loci delicti, the law where the tort applied, doesn't apply for this type of tort of contribution, because this type of tort is not a conduct regulating law. It's really a post-event remedial rule. So when you're looking at a post-event remedial rule, the first question the court has to assess is there a conflict at all? If the tort occurred in New Jersey, and we're looking at, does New Jersey law apply or does New York law apply? You look to see if there's a conflict. But CPLR 1401 and 1403 both give the right of contribution that is nearly identical to 2A:53A-1. So they're nearly identical. There's no conflict.
You're referring to the JTCL, correct?
Correct.
So the point is, regardless of which substantive law on contribution applied, they would both allow contribution to a joint tortfeasor. So there's no conflict at all, and it just doesn't matter. Here, the only reason that the JTCL would not allow them to sue Dr. Deep in New Jersey is because New Jersey cannot exercise personal jurisdiction over Dr. Deep. She could still be a joint tortfeasor under the meaning of the statute, in which case there could be contribution under the substantive law of any state wherever personal jurisdiction could be had.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's the analysis that the Cooney court goes through. And the court said they will evaluate the relative interests of jurisdictions with conflicting laws, and if neither can be accommodated without substantial impairing the other, find some other basis for resolving the impasse.
But here your point is there's no conflicting law.
Correct. So it ends the inquiry. There's a right in New York. He can bring it. And the question as to the statute of limitations that I believe Justice Patterson asked for, it's CPLR 213 is the statute of limitations, and it is a 6-year statute that doesn't arise until there's actually a judgment. So while the tort might have been in 2018, it doesn't matter because there is no judgment yet. There's no finding. So the claim just hasn't even accrued yet.
So no impediment to seeking contribution in New York after the verdict is returned.
Correct, Your Honor.
You want to address counsel's argument about the delay?
I don't think the delay is a factor that this court should consider in terms of whether or not you go on the verdict sheet. That's not an equitable reason because they still have a right. As long as that right's not extinguished, then there's no reason. So in going through how the courts have resolved these issues, first they look at the plain language. So here, the plain language for the Comparative Negligence Act resolves this question. So I don't think you need to get to all those exceptions under the case law. But even if you would—
Is it your position, because the term party has been mentioned, and of course, Young versus Latta changed that. It didn't really address it specifically, but Young versus Latta had settling parties, as the term goes. But the reality is that a party that settles is not a party at the time of the verdict, right?
Correct.
So the board party has expanded to include ex-parties, former parties, who for one reason or another are not in the case. We have Maison, we have Krasowski, some situations where there were people who are not even identified and never raised as parties. But as noted, there are some special considerations there. But does the term parties mean something broader than the current parties in the case?
I do not believe it does. I believe it means a party who, I think Justice Wiener after said it best, that it's an actor who could or could have been a party. So here, because of due process, Dr. Deep couldn't be a party. So under the Comparative Negligence Act, it would be unfair to call that person a party because they're a non-party. They can't be, it's beyond the reach of this court. And if we look back to the Ramos decision and what the Ramos court said, the employer is not a party because statutorily they're immune. So I think if you compare and kind of triage how you look at due process, that due process and lack of jurisdiction trumps a statutory immunity. So it's even greater than. So if the employer in Ramos couldn't be a party, then there's no way a non-party who's beyond the reach of this court can't be hailed into court under our concepts of due process, then they can't be considered a party for the comparative negligence.
But you have situations that are a little bit analogous to Ramos, such as the statute of repose is run, or the without an affidavit of merit, the lawsuit's not going to last as against the defendant. So those defendants get a sort of immunity, whether immunity is the right term, obviously tort claims, immunity, true immunity. So party as used in this context, is not limited to current parties who are before the court at that time.
Well, I think that those exceptions go to people who could have been a party. So if we look at the Mejia versus Quest case, the court had the affidavit of merit wasn't filed by defendant who had third partied in the other medical provider. And the court there had said that basically that third party defendant had to actively defend the litigation, while the only reason that they're defending is to have an impact on the fault, they had to be there. And that's what I think Justice Noriega's concern was about, this jury confusion that if there's this non-party who's not participating. But I think it's one step even further, because Dr. Deep isn't there to defend herself, that you'd be relying upon plaintiffs.
But respectfully, those concerns occur. The courts have found a way to explain to the jury what the situation is, right? I mean, that happens in all of these different contexts, most obviously where there's a settling party. The jury doesn't find out there's a settlement, and that just, it's a commonplace occurrence that a party no longer in the case is on the verdict sheet and the jury has to make a determination.
Yeah. So I think in looking at the cases, you can put them in two separate categories. The one being that the plaintiff did something wrong. And I think that's the easy case. So I don't know if I really need to address it, but the others where plaintiff didn't do anything wrong. So the Brodsky case, the bankruptcy case, that case I think is most concerning. And that's the one that I think that I have the most problem with the results, because you basically take out an at-fault party and you aren't able to collect against them. But that case actually is the easier to resolve, because the reason for the court's holding is in the Comparative Negligence Act itself. It talks about the fact that if this were an environmental tort, the legislature knew to put in that if they were bankrupt, you can go against anyone else. So basically the reverse is what occurred, that it wasn't an environmental tort and therefore we're going to allow them on the verdict sheet to allocate fault because of the principle of the, I don't want to get my Latin wrong, yes, the expressio unius est exclusion alterius. So because the court specifically put that in the case, that because the Comparative Negligence Act excluded environmental torts, and this was not environmental tort, then that's how we get to the result. So that's because it was the legislature's prerogative. So here, if the legislature wanted to redefine party to mean just anyone, even if they're beyond the scope of personal jurisdiction, then they could do so after this court were to make its decision. But right now, as the law stands now, the statute doesn't permit that interpretation.
questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
The only other concern was Justice Patterson had asked about an overpayment concern. And here there's two remedies that defendant has available, even if there is not a fault allocation on the verdict sheet. The first is what the court was asking about before, the proximate cause, that that's still an issue that's going to be litigated at trial, and they can still make that argument. And then the second is the statutory right. If there is a judgment, then the defendant can go to New York. So I would ask the court to interpret the plain language of the Comparative Negligence Act and to hold that a party who is beyond the reach of personal jurisdiction is excluded from allocation on a verdict sheet.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
I neglected to mention earlier, Justice Pierre-Louis is participating in this case. She'll be watching the argument. Brief rebuttal, no more than just a few minutes.
I'll just tackle the arguments in reverse order. The main focus of Amicus's brief is that that Dr. Deep is not a party to the New Jersey action and therefore shouldn't be on the verdict sheet. But I would submit to this court that the term party should not be so strictly construed. They were not parties in Mason. They were not parties in Krasowski, which is why I focused on them. And they were not parties in Krantz. And Krantz says it right in the in its opinion. In this case, the New York defendants were never parties to the suit, nor could they have been, because it's undisputed that New Jersey lacked personal jurisdiction. So even though they're not parties in a New Jersey action, they were allowed to be on the verdict sheet.
Well, in Young, they weren't current parties. And in really the whole, really all of the rest of the cases, Burt, Brandt, Brodsky, as well as the ones you mentioned, Jones, all of them, they were former parties or could have been parties had they been properly included.
You're right. Those were former parties, but in Krantz, they were never parties.
In Krantz, they were parties with the plaintiff in a separate action related to the same tort.
Right. But what the focus here is looking at the language of the Comparative Negligence Act, which says the word parties. And I'm suggesting to this court that based upon case law interpreting that statute, that the Comparative Negligence Act should not be construed so strictly to mean parties in New Jersey action, whether they are not parties as in Mason or Krasowski, or they are party to another action but not New Jersey. Those have all been considered to be exceptions and have allowed to be on the verdict sheet in New Jersey. Both counsel have continually relied upon the Ramos case. And Ramos case had one huge overriding factor in that there was a workers' compensation bar. So that case is not analogous to this case. And that was the reason why the employer could not be on the verdict sheet for which the employee can try to get allocation. Mr. Donnelly brought up that the claim, and I'll just address it very briefly, that Dr. Deep was not even a joint tortfeasor. I would disagree with that respectfully, but even if Dr. Deep is considered not to be a joint tortfeasor under the Glassman case, the remedy is still comparative negligence. Mr. Donnelly brought up the autopsy report, understanding you're not the fact finder, you're not deciding the case, but factually, that autopsy report does not say why the patient had a cardiac arrest during a very minor short procedure under mild sedation. And the reason is because Dr. Deep doubled the lisinopril, which increased the potassium, which caused her to have an unexpected and unpredictable cardiac arrest.
Let's move beyond.
Yeah. So in any case, I do believe, and it was really not addressed by counsel, that the equities of the situation in having and forcing the defendants in this case to bring a subsequent contribution action are real. And that's something that's easily remedied should the plaintiff have chosen to sue Dr. Deep. If the plaintiff's theory is they don't want to sue Dr. Deep, they had their experts look at it, and they determined that Dr. Deep did nothing wrong in the case, then they can make that argument at trial just as they are here.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. And thank you to counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.